Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Classic English Literature Podcast. Thank you all for coming. I hope you'll oblige me by posting a positive review of the show on your preferred podcast platform. Hit the subscribe button, like all my social media posts, and if you can spare a dime, send it to me by hitting the support the show button in the upper right-hand corner of the Buzzsprout homepage. I hope you love today's show. The perennial complaint from students with which a literature teacher must deal is the "what do I need this for?" question. Why do I have to learn this? When will I ever use this? How will this help me get a job? I hate this question. And I hate it for a couple of reasons, not least of which is the fact that I've no very good answer, really. You don't need this. You'll probably never use it. It won't help you get a job. In fact, your best case scenario is that you'll end up like me, a rumpled, poorly dressed public servant with an expanding waistline, receding hairline, and incipient alcoholism. Now, I used to wax poetic about expanding the mind, about building empathy, about the aesthetic pleasure of language. And when that failed, I urged the utility of clear communication skills, the ability to write, speak, and think cogently, skills that every company desires. But interest in the humanities continues to decline to crisis proportions. And every day one can read a creed occur for the death of the English major or the end of history as a discipline. And I understand. Literary study is not necessarily an easy endeavor, and if you're not constitutionally attracted to it, the effort can easily seem misspent. Additionally, if you're a taxpayer, you probably want to see some concrete return on investment for your education tax dollars. All this I accept. But there's still a part of me, deep down inside, that resents the assumption that literature or art has to be useful. Now, for most modern people, the aesthetic or cultural experience, it's insufficient. It must do something. But I think something can be useless without being worthless. And so I quibble, perhaps, with today's writer, Sir Philip Sidney, whose defense of Poesy is generally regarded as the high point of Elizabethan literary criticism. Sidney is the quintessential Tudor mundane, dashing, educated, handsome, impeccably dressed. A courtier, soldier, a diplomat who reified Baldassare Castiglione's notion of a gentlemanly excellence in his Book of the Courtier, a how-to guide to Renaissance flash. Quote, "I have discovered a universal rule which seems to apply more than any other in all human actions or words, namely, to steer away from affectation at all costs, as if it were a rough and dangerous reef, and, to use perhaps a novel word for it, to practice in all things a certain nonchalance, a sprezzatura, which conceals all artistry and makes whatever one says or does seem uncontrived and effortless." Sidney's work, both his poetry and prose, strives to exemplify that deliberate insouciance. We'll look at his poetry momentarily, but I'd first like to unpack his defense of Poesy as it seems to express the deep concern he has about his literary nonchalance. Sidney composed the Defense of Poesy in probably 1582, responding to an attack on the perniciousness of poetry written by a lemon-sucking Puritan named Stephen Gosson, who, in a majestic instance of misjudging character, dedicated his The School of Abuse to Sidney. Gossin's invective against poetry was of the Platonic sort. In fact, he commends dear old Plato for banning the poet pestilence from his ideal republic. Quote, "No marvel that Plato shut them out of his school and banished them quite from his commonwealth as effeminate writers, unprofitable members, and utter enemies to virtue. Poetry tempts the young away from profitable pursuits. It weakens its readers and lures the unwary into vice and dissipation. And it's all a lie, a fiction, a false presentation of reality." Same old, same old. Look, you can plug in poetry for any number of artistic diversions, and the complaint refreshes itself. Novels, plays, radio, movies, television, the internet, social media. Oh, actually, there may be something to that last one. Might be a difference of kind rather than of degree. But that's not my point right now. The point right now is that art always attracted lemon suckers fearing that it will corrupt the youth. I'm sure there was some po-faced monk who tisk-tisked polyphony when his fellow chanters started weaving melodies together in the 12th century. And of course, we've no shortage today of contemptua ex smugglies canceling and censoring anything that smacks of fun. So, from here on out, let's accept that Sidney lets poesy stand for all written arts. Philip Sidney wanted nothing to do with Gossin's grumbling. And so he launches a quite elegant rebuttal. But in that great spirit of sprezzatura, he delivers his classically formal forensic defense in an easy but cultivated prose. I suppose because it is a classic apology, it accepts the terms of Gossin's argument, which is, in effect, that if poetry is to be tolerated, it must do something good. Please see my earlier quibble. But that's what Sidney agrees to and sets about battling the prosecution. Sidney's primary thesis is that, quote, "Virtue is the most excellent resting place for all worldly learning to make his end of." And that, quote, "I affirm that no learning is so good as that which teacheth and moveth to virtue." Now, to me, this feels like a bit of an Aristotelian defense against Plato's and Gossin's attack. Poetry must lead people to virtuous lives. But how can it do so when it is a false reality? Here, Sidney persists with his Aristotelian tack. He argues that, far from being a false reality, poets create a higher reality. Not reality as it merely is, but reality as it could be. As such, the poet is not a liar or a mere imitator, but a creator. He says, quote, "Nature never set forth the earth in so rich tapestry as divers poets have done, neither with so pleasant rivers, fruitful trees, sweet-smelling flowers, nor whatsoever else may make the too-much-loved earth more lovely. Her world is brazen. The poets only deliver a golden." He calls poets makers, sort of like the Anglo-Saxons with their shaper shops and William Dunbar with his makar. Sidney then invokes the Book of Genesis and the Imago Dei, the image of God. Quote, "Give right honor to the heavenly maker of that maker, who having made man to his own likeness, set him beyond and over all the works of that second nature, which in nothing he showeth so much as in poetry." I think we've spoken of the Imago Dei before, haven't we? You know, when God says, quote, "Make we man to our image and likeness. And God made of naught a man to his image and likeness. God made of naught a man to the image of God." Many have decided that it's the creative spark that is our relation to the Creator, not some idea of him being an anthropoid cloud lounger. So for Sidney, we'd be actualizing our God-given potential by being poets. Creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. That's what poetry is, says Sidney, a second creation. He speaks of the divine breath with which the poet brings such creations forth, likening it to the breath of God that made Adam a living soul. Now it's time for one of our etymological diversions. We speak fondly of artistic inspiration. We do. It was one of the things Plato found objectionable. Well, the word comes from this idea of divine breath. The Latin inspirare, meaning to blow into, becomes by mid-14th century English to mean, figuratively, to fill the mind or to prompt to do something. That Latin word was derived from spiritus, a breath, which came to be spirit, meaning both the substance of God and, metaphorically, life itself. Breath. Inspire, expire, respire, spirit. Now, all this is to say that Sidney makes a rather Renaissance humanist claim that poetry is a work of near-divine creation. In fact, he says it surpasses philosophy and history in its power to instruct morally. Philosophy, says he, is too general and history too particular. But, you know, like Goldilocks choosing a candidate for architectonicae, the mistress of all knowledge, poetry is just right, as it, quote, coupleth the general notion with the particular example. I suppose this is a fair argument. It certainly has held sway for centuries, though the utilitarian hordes batter at its walls. Of course, the comprehensiveness of the defense, as well as its taut argumentation and breadth of evidence, belies the indifferent sprezzatura of the ideal courtier poet. Let's have a peep at some of Sidney's verse work to see his literary theory in action. In 1580, Sidney produces the first version of the Arcadia, a book with a rather torturous composition and publication history, which includes an abandoned revision which need not detain us right now. It's based upon the 1501 Italian model by humanist Jacopo Sannazaro. Arcadia is a mountainous region in Greece, but it comes to mean any idyllic, rustic, pastoral setting, the locus amenus, the lovely place. In Sidney's work, two princes named Pericles and Musidorus wander into Arcadia on their way back home to Thrace. A debate about Pericles mooning over the picture of the Duke of Arcadia's daughter culminates in a lovely description of the countryside. It's a complexly constructed piece of work. Sidney alternates prose and verse in a five-act comedy structure, sprinkles in that pastoral setting, in the service of a plot full of Alexandrian tropes, including mistaken identity, shipwrecks, and pirate abductions. The full Monty here, folks. There's little wonder he lost control of this one. But there's a song in Arcadia called Ye Goat Herd Gods that's rather interesting. It's a singing competition slash dialogue between two young swains in love with Urania, the Greek goddess of astronomy who became the muse of Christian poets. The two singers take turns by stanza and parallel each other's thoughts as the poem progresses. So, for instance, Strephon, the first singer, begins by calling upon, quote, ye goat-herd gods that love the grassy mountains, ye nymphs which haunt the springs in pleasant valleys, ye satyrs joyed with free and quiet forests. While Clias begins, O Mercury, foregoer to the evening, O heavenly huntress of the savage mountains, O lovely star entitled of the morning. After the invocations, both singers make the same request, quote, vouchsafe your silent ears to plaining music. So, after they've settled the audience comfortably in a suitably bucolic paradise, the poem moves to a somewhat elegiac phase, in which Strephon and Clias each recall more carefree days in the wild forests, and how now they are, quote, banished now among the monstrous mountains of huge despair, and heartbroken so that molehills seem like mountains. Now, you're a clever reader, you might note that not only do these passages seem similar in tone and spirit to the Anglo-Saxon elegies we've studied, but they also retain that alliteration that ties Sidney's poem firmly to its ancestors. Nice mingling of the classical and the Germanic here, Phil. Nah, anyway, there's another neat little Rococo touch throughout the poem. There's a bit of synesthesia, that is, the mingling of sense experiences. So Clias says, quote, I feel a noisome scent. Touch and smell overlapping here. Tiny little things, but evidence of that carefully cultivated nonchalance, so characteristic of Sidney's best work. There's two other things to point out here about this poem. One, it's a double sestina. A few of those will give you quite a headache in the morning, let me tell you. No. A sestina is a poem of six-line stanzas and a triplet, and it must use the same six words in a specific pattern at the end of each stanza's lines. So there's 39 lines and six terminal words in a standard sestina. Sidney goes big, pumping up to 78 lines with the same six words. Mountains, valleys, forests, evening, morning, and the other one, music. It's quite a feat of dictionary acrobatics to get those repetitions to resonate with new and interesting overtones instead of becoming really monotonous. Two, while written in our trusty iambic pentameter, the lines often have more than the traditional 10 syllables. This is called hypercatalexis, if you care, and you shouldn't, really. The 11th, or sometimes also a 12th, syllable doesn't receive a stress, and is what we used to call, in a less enlightened age, a feminine ending. Happily, we now register how offensive such labeling can be, and we've decided to call it instead a weak ending. There. That's better, isn't it? Anyway, the effect works well, for that downbeat line ending nicely underscores the plaintive content of the song. But for me, the most interesting part of the text are stanzas 7 and 8. In these passages, each singer repeats the word meseems three times. The word means, quite obviously, probably, it seems to me. Okay, so we're talking about personal impressions. So the lads say, quote, and this is Strephon, meseems I see the high and stately mountains transform themselves to low dejected valleys. Meseems I hear in these ill-changed forests the nightingales do learn of owls their music. Meseems I feel the comfort of the morning turn to the mortal serene of an evening. And Clias responds, meseems I see a filthy cloud evening as soon as sun begins to climb the mountains. Meseems I feel a noisome scent the morning when I do smell the flowers of these valleys. Meseems I hear, when I do hear sweet music, the dreadful cries of murdered men in forests. Right, so these guys are so depressed and lovelorn that everything beautiful and majestic appears to them ugly and base. I suppose anyone who's ever had a broken heart can relate. But what Sidney's doing here is using a kind of personification the cool kids call the pathetic fallacy. That is, attributing human emotions and behaviors to inanimate objects. Stately mountains become dejected valleys. Stately is merely an adjective, but dejected is an adjective that implies some kind of psychology at work, right? It's also what the cool kids call a displaced epithet, because it's the speaker who's dejected, right? Not the valley. What we've got here, and elsewhere in the poem, is two young men almost literally recreating nature in their own image, perceiving a reality through the filter of their own emotional state. They are poets in all senses of Sidney's broad definition. Sidebar. Did you catch the line about nightingales learning the owl's music? For a fuller examination of that pairing, pour yourself a nice cup of tea, grab a cookie, and listen to episode 8 of the podcast, Avian Agitation, on Nicholas of Guilford's The Owl and the Nightingale. Let's move on, dear listeners, because I do want to speak on Sidney's sonnet cycle called Astrophil and Stella from about 1581. It's the first full Petrarchan-style sonnet sequence in English, and rather set the vogue for them for the rest of the 16th century. As Petrarch had his Laura, and Wyatt his Anne, so Sidney has his Penelope Devereux. The names of the title, Astrophil, from the Greek meaning star lover, and also perhaps a play on Sidney's given name, Philip, and Stella, from the Latin for star, are metafictional projections of Sidney and Devereux, he being the forlorn lover, forced to pine as his beloved marries another, though rather unhappily as I understand it, but I will spill no tea. The narrative hinted at by the sequence revolves around Astrophil's infatuation with Stella, an embodiment of beauty and perfection. The sonnets capture Astrophil's intense emotions, his desires, frustrations, and the conflicting aspects of love. Sidney delves into the themes of unattainability, the limitations of language to express true feelings, and the consequences of pursuing forbidden love while ricocheting from passionate longing to desperate self-doubt. Some critics note that the cycle has 108 sonnets, one for each of Penelope's suitors in the Odyssey, and that the whole piece actually contains 119 poems, there's 11 songs. So that's one for each month of Odysseus's journey back to Penelope, but one. So like the name Star Lover and Star, perhaps Sidney confirms Astrophil's failure and frustration in these oblique Homeric allusions. In perhaps another structural echo of Astrophil's erratic emotions, Sidney feels no need to stick consistently with one sonnet form in this cycle. While generally Petrarchan, he does employ some 15 different rhyming patterns, and he's also quite liberal with development of the sestets, sometimes using couplets, tercets, and quatrains whenever he feels like it. Sonnet 1 introduces us to Astrophil's plight, and we get some rather conventional longing and sighing and pining. He loves, quote, "in truth and fain in verse my love to show." He hopes Stella will read his poetry, know that he loves her, therefore pity him and grant him her grace. But he then realizes that such invention will not do. And that's a cool word in this context, invention. One, it points to the sonnets and Sidney's concern that poetry, and especially English poetry, should be original and less dependent upon the Elizabethan convention of imitation. Though Astrophil reads through the courtly love poetry of the past, quote, "oft turning others' leaves to see if thence would flow some fresh and fruitful showers upon my sunburned brain, but words came halting forth." Not until the muse chastises him, saying, "Fool, look in thy heart and write." Ha ha! Remember that thinking I thing I keep bringing up? Here it is again, in a statement that could easily be seen as the credo of the Romanticists of the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Indeed, even now, the general conception of poetry, writing, or indeed any art, really, is the expression of the artist's psyche. That is, according to Sidney, true poetry.
Oh, but sir, he does this in Petrarchan styles through a persona named Astrophil, hardly soul-bearing in the romantic idiom, sir.
Yes, I'm aware, but baby steps, yeah?
Oh, and sir, he writes the first sonnet in Alexandrines.
What?
Alexandrines, sir. 12-syllable lines from French poetry. Sidney does shift the accent pattern about to make it fit English better, but it's French Alexandrines all the same, sir.
Yes, well done, enthusiastic and polite pupil.
Thank you, sir.
Where were we? Ah, yes. Sonnet 3 begins with some haughty snark. Quote, "Let dainty wits cry on the sisters nine that bravely masked their fancies may be told." Basically, let weak minds turn to the muses for their artificial inspiration. Stella is the true muse. Quote, "In Stella's face I read what love and beauty be, then all my deed but copying is what in her nature writes." That's actually a rather complicated little shift. The nine muses are artificial, and those who rely upon them merely imitative or derivative. But Stella is the epitome of love and beauty, so Astrophil merely needs to copy what nature has written. So, nature is the poet, in a Sidneyan sense, not Astrophil or Sidney? This could be seen to contradict Sidney's assertion in the defense that a poet creates a second, perhaps better nature, but only if we fully accept that Sidney and Astrophil are one and the same, and I don't necessarily think it's hermeneutically safe to do so. Certainly, Astrophil is a projection, a persona, based on Sidney, but it doesn't follow that one is exchangeable with the other. Indeed, if that were so, why bother creating the character? But the lines can get a bit muddy, I'll grant that. In Sonnet 14, Astrophil compares himself to Prometheus, the Titan who defied the Olympian gods to give humankind fire, and thus civilization. Some myths even credit Prometheus with creating humanity from the mud, little mud dolls he made. Gods do love to play in the dirt, don't they? While Sidney's allusion is to Prometheus's torment for his disobedience, quote, "Alas, have I not pain enough, my friend, upon whose breast a fiercer gripe doth tire than did on him who first stole down the fire?" The associations of self-sufficiency and self-fashioning cannot be overlooked. But in Sonnet 25, Sidney sneers a bit at poets who, with, quote, "Poor Petrarch's long-deceased woes, with newborn sighs and denizened wit do sing." He's attacking writers who adapt Italian models into English verse. Hello, pot? This is kettle. Well, perhaps he's probably talking about lesser poets, and if it's true, you're not arrogant, right? Let's finish with a look at Sonnet 71. As it seems a fair summation of this episode's main themes of sprezzatura, originality, and virtue. Sidney writes, quote, "Who will in fairest book of nature know how virtue may best lodged in beauty be? Let him but learn of love to read in thee, Stella, those fair lines which true goodness show." Forever and forever in these poems, Astrophil recognizes the vast difference separating him from Stella. She is an apotheosis of true nature, true beauty, true virtue. She is so far above him that he can neither invent nor imitate his way to her. It's a fair metaphor for Sidney's own literary ambitions, ever inventive and interpretive, densely learned but lightly executed, blasé yet earnest. I don't think it's too much to say that although Sir Philip Sidney is an arch-Elizabethan courtier and poet, he also devised an almost archetypal idea of a poet, like, ironically enough, a Platonic form of poet. Even in 2023, when we think of a poet, we have two basic ideas, don't we? We've got the long-haired fellow in a frilly shirt, head in hand over an escutoire. Or we've got some bescarfed beatnik, black sunglasses, black turtleneck, and a beret, a Galois cigarette hanging from the lips with a studied indifference. I think both of these find their roots in Sir Philip Sidney. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you real soon.